Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we have a, what, collection, collage, potpourri of subjects.
You never can tell, huh?
All of them good.
Yeah, there you go, all of them good. Some of them even tasty.
Again, and delicious. And
yeah, that too.
Yeah, now, I mean, Amelia Salzman is all about delicious, and she's such a fine writer. And she has a seasonal Jewish kitchen cookbook out, which, of course, is perfect timing for the Jewish holidays occurring in September. But even if you're not doing Jewish holidays, she has enough seasonal for the advent of fall.
Yeah,
we're moving into that season too in September.
Watch out! She's got six seasons instead of four, just to make it even more complicated. So you better listen carefully because you'll learn a lot as long as you keep
track. I love that idea. About 8 years ago, I think it was, we interviewed Amelia Salzman with her book. It was the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook, and we didn't know, even Amelia said she didn't know at the time, that this was going to become such an enduring classic in food writing. But it's on every bookstore shelf still today. And I think she's got another winner here. Her newest book is The Seasonal Jewish Kitchen, which is a fresh take on tradition. And like the first book, it makes me want to move immediately to California. But Amelia can tell you about seasonal cooking. It can happen just about everywhere as long as you're not trying to grow lemons, right?
Well, perhaps even lemons. It's so nice to be back with you again, Ann. Thank you for having me.
A gorgeous book. I mean, you have to be just thrilled to bits to see it. Just what
I
it looks
am.
Like as
I
well
am.
As what it is. Because I love what it is, too.
It was a real labor of love with close friends and family working together. The photographer and I worked very closely together to create something very meaningful to share with readers, and we hope will feel fresh and maybe offer some surprises.
There are many surprises. First of all, I guess you expressed it in the introduction when you said, is this Jewish food? Who knew?
That's a great lead into this because it really did frame why I wanted to write this book. Jews have lived all over the world. The diaspora is thousands of years in the making. And one person's idea of what Jewish food means to them is completely different than someone else's.
Oh, sure.
And truth is that Jewish cuisine is really a global patchwork of regional cooking that has evolved over centuries, millennia really, into what has become Jewish cuisine of a particular culture. So if you're from Tunisia, you basically cook Tunisian food and those dishes are your traditional foods.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been adapted, let's say, to work within the religious Jewish context, for instance. So to give a perfect example, schmaltz and gribanis, which an Ashkenazi Jew from Europe, chicken fat or duck fat, and cracklins, poultry skin cracklins, that evolved in a region where pork and pork products and bacon were the regional cuisine. Well, that is not in keeping with the kashrut. So for Jews of that region, they were cooking regional food, chicken, and adapting the regional style of cooking, using meat fat, for instance, for a meat menu. You couldn't use butter, which would be dairy, mm-hmm. which again would not be part of the kashrut. I find the cultural sort of journey of the food and why we cook what we cook or why certain people cooked what they cooked really so endlessly interesting and intriguing. It's like following a mystery map, if you will. And I wanted to get to the why of different foods. I found it really so, talking about the connections and the chain, you know, how all of these things link together. And I just wanted to sort of show that.
Well, no, I mean, you are particularly, though, well, I don't want to say equipped, but, I mean, if you didn't have the heritage that you have, you would not be absolutely so sharp on with these issues. I mean, it's an amazing background. Explain to our listeners.
Well, thank you. You know, that really does raise a good point because, as I said, like, I am sort of an example of what the diaspora is. My mother is Romanian. My father is Iraqi. Each of their families emigrated to Palestine in their early 30s, and that's where they were raised. They met in the Israeli army, and they moved to the United States to study and ended up staying, but that's where I was born and raised. So I have this very eclectic background, a melting pot background, if you will, or a patchwork background, whichever image works for you. But it did give me I've always lived with the view that Jewish food was not only one thing, or the flavors, what would be considered Jewish cuisine, are not simply deli meats, kugel, chicken soup, those flavors, but are the vibrant Israeli flavors of that have North African influence as well as Eastern influence and now Russian influence and just a great diversity of definitions of what is Jewish food.
Well, now, this leads us to explaining your organization. When you say seasonal, you have a specific seasonal in mind here. Explain your organization of this cookbook.
Well, as you know, I've been teaching and writing about seasonal cooking for a very long time. And to my mind, it's always been a way of helping people access not just what tastes best, but how to make their lives easier, how to help when they're worried about matters of sustainability and so on. But what I've learned over the years is that rather than organizing our lives in four seasons, it actually is much easier and makes a lot more sense to organize our lives in the way we look at food in six micro-seasons, two-month seasons. September, October, November, December, and so on. And it's just an easier way to know what is ripe when, what you might find, where to focus your attention. Well, when I looked at the Jewish calendar and through this seasonal lens, I suddenly realized that the holidays and the lunar calendar really echoed these cycles of the year. And I get chills now as I'm telling you about this because it was just such an extraordinary deep connection of giving meaning to what we do sometimes just, you know, because we just do it. We're in the habit.
But that's
so
sort of the basis.
The book in two-month chapters, starting with September, October, which is the beginning of the Jewish year. And when you organize the year like that, you see that the shifting dates of the lunar calendar always contain, in those two-month time frames of the national, regular calendar, you'll always find the holidays in their right time frame. And the foods of those holidays are absolutely the traditional foods wherever you are. Tap in to, and whatever your heritage, Ashkenazic, Sephardic, Iraqi, Romanian, some foods that you eat during that particular holiday time will be reflected in what is naturally available seasonally. I find that to be a very profound and meaningful way of observing wonderful holiday meals together and sharing and marking the moment.
Now let's take, since you mentioned September, and September is coming up in a couple of weeks' time, why don't you give our listeners an insight into your view of the seasonal foods that will be in season in September and October?
I'd be happy to, Peter.
Sure.
So, for instance, European-type plums, the prune plums, are often in season. They're the latest of the stone fruits, and they tend to be often in September. And why it's very traditional in Europe, in Central Europe, to make desserts for Rosh Hashanah using these prune plums. You might, of course, pomegranates are in season. I'm sort of going straight for the very symbolic foods of the holidays. Pomegranates are a first fruit that we would see in September, maybe even October, that many people have on their table at this time of year so that one might have been eat in a symbolic way that may our lives and our blessings and our good deeds of the coming year be as plentiful as the, and here's my seasonal wonkiness, the L's, A-R-I-L-S, of a pomegranate.
Right. Everybody calls them seeds, but you're calling them arils, yeah.
You know, so the seed is a little hard bit inside the L. But, so you would find that. You would find Concord grapes. You would find apples. You would find early winter squash. You would find the beginning, you know, sweet potatoes. You would also find, this is a time of what's called a shoulder season, where you still see late summer tomatoes, eggplants, zucchini, as well as shell beans, dried beans, the beginning harvests of nuts and dates, depending on where you live. And these are all the foods that we tend to reach for at this time of year. So it's just this very natural connection of what we want to eat, and isn't that a happy coincidence? It's right there available to us.
Yeah, well, I think it's not accidental, and I don't think that it's the only connection. I mean, you go explore pre-Columbian cultures, and I think you'll find the same thing. You try the Indian, I can't remember the name of the fall holiday that they do. They do, it looks very much like the fall Jewish holiday with the structure with sometimes it's in wood rather than real fruit and harvest and straw and whatnot. And Peter's looking at me crazy.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm saying it's more universal than you think.
I don't think you know what you're talking about.
I do. I do.
Okay.
I think it's universal that people live in this world with the climates and the seasons. And, I mean, the moon is so strong that it moves the tides. So somebody along the line would have had to have noticed the lunar cycles. You know what I mean? I think it's ageless.
It is ageless, and it is absolutely a universal truth. And it's one that, I'm not inventing something new here. I just want to sort of open up those boxes that these things are tucked away in and say, look at this. Isn't this extraordinary? Our place in not only in the cycles of the year, but our place in in the history of the world. So these foods are mentioned in the Bible, since we're talking about Jewish cooking, although if you're looking at the Old Testament, right, this is a Judeo-Christian touchstone. But if you read Leviticus and Exodus, the imagery of the seasonal foods is extraordinary. If you're reading the Bible for literature and mining it for agriculture and food references, you'll find recipes, you'll find ancient thousands of year old meaning to the things that I think what we're saying is we're just simply not paying attention to what's right in front of us. How interconnected it all is.
But see, you add another layer. I mean, if you weren't a brilliant cook,
why, thank you, Ann. When are you coming to dinner?
You ask. I mean, there are all these cookbooks out there, but I mean, where did Tunisian lemon rind salad come from? It's wonderful sounding.
Well, so Tunisian lemon rind salad with harissa. This is a little recipe from my cousin's wife, whose family is Tunisian. So, what a great example that you brought forward. We were sitting and talking. My husband and I were in Israel a year and a half ago or so, a little more than a year ago, visiting my family. And my cousin Adi was telling me about this incredible salad that his wife Edna makes. And it's made from lemon rind. So it's kind of like a play on, I mean, if you know about preserved lemons that we're kind of familiar with now,
yes,
from Moroccan cooking, let's say. So it has that salty quality to it, but it's a completely different idea. If you've squeezed the juice out of the lemons, now you've got the lemon rinds, and you can you cook them with water, you boil them to get sort of some of the bitterness out and to tenderize them. And then you make almost a condiment in, it's called, there are many salad kuit, which means cooked salads, in the North African cuisines. So this lemon rind salad is one of them. It can be very spicy if you like it very spicy. But it's a great condiment with fish, grilled fish and chicken and so on. And it was just, you know, I think I just was keeping my eyes and ears open and my taste buds awake, and I was like, oh, my goodness. So that's how that recipe came to be in this book.
It's wonderful. You know, another one that I'm just drooling over is apple, pear, and Concord grape galette in rye pastry with ginger cream. I mean, that's heavenly sounding.
Well, I'm not going to argue with you. I'm going to agree. It's pretty delicious.
Yes.
And this is very, has a very European sensibility. And of course, it focuses on the fall, you know, what we have an abundance of in the fall, pears and apples. And rather than seasoning food with sweetened Concord wine, why not go to the source and actually use the Concord grapes, which have such an extraordinary flavor. I love seasoning food with food. In other words, using the flavor of an ingredient to be an accent. And rye flour, which of course is pretty much a Jewish touchstone when you think about rye bread. It gives a nutty earthiness that is just perfect in an autumn rustic tart.
Now, I mean, you tackle some old standards in this book, too.
I do.
You do. The one that intrigued me was, I thought it was funny, your mother's chicken soup, which is a ruler we can use to address the quality of any food made. And you said your mother was a hopeless cook. Yeah, well, what is it about the soup?
Okay, well, you know, some dishes like chicken soup, you just need to know a great way to make a delicious one. It doesn't need to be modernized, but it's certainly, you know, a lot of times chicken soup gets a bad rap for, you know, being I don't know what, but we're not even going to go there. But a great chicken soup should be rich with the essence of chicken and the vegetables that gave their soul to make the soup. And not too much else. I think that a great chicken soup is like a great French stock, is essential. And one of the things, you bring up something very interesting about my mother's chicken soup. Many recipes in the book, or many recipes in life, really, can unlock stories of family and food of memory, and of how we find our way, you know, as strangers in a strange land, to recreate our what we ache for and to evolve. And so this story, my mother's chicken soup, is really a story about her journey, her personal journey, and how even though she didn't cook as a child or as a young teenager, she had three older sisters who were helping her mother. Their mother, when she came to the United States and began to learn need to cook, she right away went to the memories that she had of how something should taste, and she became a wonderful, I would call her a natural cook. She's not particularly a baker, but she had a wonderful palate. She still has a wonderful palate. And so she really makes a fantastic chicken soup.
Well, I'm going to try because that's one of our most favorite dishes. We could do this all day with these recipes. Every time you turn a page and there's a new recipe that's intriguing, and that's where everybody's going to find a lot of surprises. But you cover this so thoroughly with the pantry, how to use the book, techniques, that, you know, basic recipes. So, I mean, you can't miss in this book, I think.
Thank you so much. That really makes me feel
just
wonderful, because I really do want people to feel that they can cook. We may, you know, you mentioned about my recipes. I think that readers will find them very accessible. Many of them are very, very simple to make. Just a few ingredients and a couple of little simple techniques. It's very true to my style of cooking, which is intuitive, simple. Life should be simple. Let the ingredients speak. And it will be a big payoff.
And then I will add fresh and lively. And again, the book is The Seasonal Jewish Kitchen. And Amelia Saltzman, you did it again.
And she does not answer the question, for what is the season for Kentucky Fried Chicken?
I think that's an evergreen recipe, Peter.
I think that's what it is.
Amelia, good talking to you again.
I'm going to steal ideas from your chicken soup recipe, I feel sure. So thank you for sharing it, and we'll let your mother know if we really like it.
Thanks a lot, Amelia.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and get your geography books out.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. Where is Senegal? Why do we care? Well, here's a man who's going to explain that. What's his name? Pierre?
Pierre Thiam. And it's well, I knew nothing about Senegalese food, but now I know it's a very rich culture.
Well, you know, Pierre Thiam, you could put what I knew before I got your book about Senegal in the proverbial walnut shell. Not very much. I blame, actually, my old geography teachers. They spent almost no time in Africa, and it's become such an important source of all kinds of things that I feel really at a loss.
Interestingly enough, Pierre, I'm a geographer by academic training.
So, wow.
So I knew exactly where Senegal was.
Well, I mean, I knew where it was, but I don't know. I didn't know anything about it. Barely, you're right.
And I wouldn't say I know a lot about it either, but I know a whole lot more about it now, thanks to a truly magnificent book called, guess what?
Senegal. And it's subtitled Modern Senegalese Recipes, From the Source to the Bowl, which is, of course, what the whole book touches on. This is more than just a cookbook, Pierre, is it not? You are a trained chef, I might point out, and a fine food writer and an ambassador for African cuisine. You travel and lecture. You've had two restaurants in Brooklyn, so you have a mission. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. I like that word. I feel like I have a mission to introduce a beautiful food culture to this part of the world, to the rest of the world, because it's unknown, and yet it's known, because our cuisine has influenced many parts of the world, as you can see when you read through the book, from the southern part of America to Latin America to, you know, many other places, you know, even in when you go down to Spain, where Spain didn't have rice before the Moors arrived, and the Moors brought that rice culture. So, you know, again, yes, this is the mission.
Can you give us a little bit of, for those people who maybe have a dot in their heads on where Senegal is on the extreme western coast of Africa, can you give us just a little bit of the history and geography that lies behind this whole cuisine?
Well, Senegal is located, like you said, in the most western coast of Africa, so it's a natural point of entrance to the continent. It's in the Atlantic Ocean, so it's a coastal country. And it's south of the Sahara Desert. So it's semi-desert, especially in the north, in the northern part. I grew up in a city, the capital city called Dakar. So it's a very dry, that part of the world. But the southern part of Senegal is completely different. It's more like lush, it's tropical, it's rains, and it's still coastal. So you have lots of seafood, of course, in the daily diet of Senegalese people. And because of this geographical location, Senegal has been in history the point of entrance, like I said. So our colonial past, we were colonized by the French. The French arrived and settled in Senegal for a few hundred years before even venturing in the rest of Africa. And all the colonial powers, like the Portuguese came in the south of Senegal, which is where my parents are from, in Casamance. Casamance, actually, the name even has a Portuguese connotation. It means, it comes from Casa de Mansa. You know, so, yeah, and we still speak Portuguese Creole in that part of Senegal. So the northern part, everywhere in Senegal, the official language is French. But in the southern part, the lingua franca is still Portuguese Creole. And my mother, she would definitely speak Portuguese Creole to me for the most part, you know, as I was growing up. So you know, I grew up speaking Portuguese Creole, French, and of course Wolof, which is the official national language that all Senegalese speak.
Yes, then you have where it is, and the diversity of terrain, which you explore in this book. Let's jump on the rest of the people who migrated there that influenced your cuisine too. There's the French, the Portuguese.
Yeah, well, you have also the Vietnamese. Yes, the Vietnamese came because of the we had the same French colonial past, and the story starts with whenever there were tensions in parts of the French colonial empire, they would send a special force that was made of Senegalese soldiers. They would send them to Vietnam, that was called Indochina at the time. They even sent them to Algeria. Wherever they were mentioned, they would send those Senegalese. But the Senegalese, when the French lost the Indochine War, the Senegalese soldiers returned to Senegal with a big number of Vietnamese immigrants that came along with them, and they settled to Senegal, and they've been in Senegal for now a few generations. Actually, I happen to be my godfather is one of those Vietnamese who migrated to Senegal with his mother and sister, and they stayed there. They're part of our fabric.
I think your book also says there are some Lebanese there too.
Oh yes, there's a big Lebanese and Syrian.
Why?
Well, again, that story is still not very clear to me how they arrived, but very present, and with their food, actually. They have, there are some avenues in Dakar that are just completely Lebanese, from shawarma to tabbouleh to all of it. They're part of our, and they bring the great thing about these immigrants, they bring their cuisine, and the Senegalese, we embrace it. We embrace the Vietnamese, the spring rolls Vietnamese. A part of the Senegalese diet, you would expect to see the Vietnamese spring rolls at name birthing ceremonies. The same with the Lebanese. You expect to have shawarma, you expect to have what we call fataya. We even think it's a Senegalese dish. It's like this turnover that's filled with meat, and the ground meat is a Lebanese dish, but Senegalese just adopted it and it becomes a Senegalese dish. So we have that even for the Portuguese too. We have pastel, which is a street food from Senegal. You see it everywhere, but it's inspired from the Portuguese influence as well. You have caldo, a dish called caldo. It's similar to the caldo that you see in Portugal. It's a fish broth, and we have it in the south of Senegal. It's a fish broth with lime, and we use okra. Of course, we add some things to it. We add some ingredients like okra. You wouldn't see it in the Portuguese version, but that became our own version. So we have all those different influences become part of the Senegalese cuisine now.
Now, there was another thing going on, which you tactfully call the Colombian Exchange, but which some of us might give a slightly different name, starting with S.
Yes, the Colombian Exchange, that's interesting to talk about it. That also confirms how food travels, because we did bring some influence to the Americas, but we forget that the Americas also brought some ingredients to Africa. I take one example, peppers. A lot of people think peppers is part of African cuisine, and it's always been there, and we own it, we claim it. But peppers didn't arrive to Africa until it came from from Latin America. It came from South America to Africa, and we adopted it. And another one is peanuts. Peanuts is a big part of our diet. We have these amazing peanut sauces. And again, peanuts arrived to Africa through the Colombian Exchange. We embraced it, and the funny story is peanuts returned to America through the slave trade, but it came from Africa to the North America, so it did this triangle. So food is something that really should unify people as it travels, and people love and adopt it and make it their own. And especially in Senegal, we just take your food and it becomes ours, and we claim it, and Vietnamese have as much right to claim the names as we do, and Lebanese the same with their fatayas and their labneh. And the Colombian Exchange was a big part of bringing ingredients to Africa. Yes.
Now, there are a number. What just mentioned, so that people become aware of some of these traditional, what we think of as traditional southern foods that really came from not even just generally Africa, but specifically from Senegal, such as you mentioned, okra. But what about the different rice cultivation techniques and styles and dishes?
Yes, exactly. The rice, I'm glad you mentioned the rice. The rice is another major ingredient that came from our shores to the Americas, and we don't get enough credits for it, and yet the rice is so important in the daily diet of people. I mean, especially you see a country like Mexico. Mexico didn't have rice before the slaves brought rice to Mexico. And there's a great book called Black Rice that's done by the Harvard Press that just talks about the whole, that journey of rice. And we have our own rice culture. I'm very excited, as you can hear, about the rice thing, because I'm from the south of Senegal, where rice is sacred, and the people from that part of Senegal, the Jola people who are cultivating the rice, who are known for being rice cultivators, were targeted to be taken to the Carolinas because of their knowledge of how to grow rice. So that's some part of the history that should be really talked about a little more, because they brought a major crop to America. And the rice that we have that became the Carolina Gold is originally from Senegal. And the sad story is it was embraced here, it became the Carolina Gold, like I said. But in Senegal, because of our colonial past, the thing with colonialism was we got brainwashed to believe that everything that was local was right. Inferior, and we tended to look out for things to come from the colonial power, from France or from elsewhere. And we looked down at this rice, to make a long story short, we looked down at the great rice that we brought to the Carolina, and we started exporting rice, and we exported rice from Southeast Asia. Actually, it started with the rice from Indochine, from Vietnam, that the French would bring from Vietnam to Senegal. And there's a whole chapter about that on the book. I approached that, so the book is not really about recipes, but I talk about it because we brought this rice from Indochine. And Senegalese, as we always do, we adopted it and we made it our own. And 50 years later, after independence, we're still exporting the rice, and we are not consuming the rice from the south, that rice that's been taken to the Americas. It's still there. It's still a local rice, but just for the people for that part of Senegal, you know, they are the ones who are still using it because it's considered sacred, so they use it for cultural reasons. But the rice that Senegalese consume on a daily basis is mostly imported, and that's quite a scandal. And I would like this book to also shine the light
that's
on that. That's why I mentioned it.
Yeah, well, I hope you did.
One of the things you do, which is really interesting, is you talk about, in a sense, food as culture. Because you talk about not just recipes, which actually come at the end, so that if you're interested, you can make this. But you talk about the importance of food as part of the daily life of the Senegalese population, and how they go about as their families or as their individuals, how they combine the different things that are available in their daily diet.
Yes, food is part of the fabric of our life in Senegal. Is so important, you know. I mean, first of all, good food is very important. Everyone is, you know, from childhood. First, you have to see the context. It's a gender-based activity, so every young girl knows that she has to know how to cook, and she's trained from an early age, you know, to be working in the kitchen, and that makes a great cook. By the time she gets her teenage years, on a daily basis, that is being judged, because when lunch is served, everyone stops at home. In Senegal, life stops. Everyone comes home, and you have to expect, you're expecting great food. You're coming home to just a great meal.
Was this the book where you said, the author said that his father was the first man he ever saw cook?
No, his godfather.
His godfather, okay.
Yeah.
So.
Yes.
And he was Vietnamese, right?
He was Vietnamese, and that's why he could cook as a man.
Now, what about you? You became a chef. How did that happen?
Well, again, it was a set of circumstances, but I give credit to this man, my uncle Jean, I'm calling my uncle, my godfather Jean, who was the Vietnamese one, because growing up, every summer during school break, I would spend time with him. I would spend time at his house, and I would be See, that was my exposure to seeing a man in the kitchen. I was like, wow, I mean, this guy is like, what's wrong with this man? But then again, you know, he was making such amazing food, you know, so that really, to me, it was a way to realize that, okay, something is wrong with our culture here, something that says to us that only a woman can cook, and yet my godfather here, you know, he makes these amazing dishes. So anyway, but even with that exposure, I wasn't ready to choose cooking as a career because of this cultural background that we have. You know, kitchen belongs to women. Until I arrived to New York, and when I came to New York, I was here not to cook. I was here as a student. I was going to continue my studies in physics and chemistry. You know, I was far from thinking that cooking would be a career until I got a job in a restaurant, just chance, you know, and this restaurant job was a busboy job, but my love for food just got rekindled by looking at what was happening in the kitchen, and the chef from that restaurant turned out to be this great guy who noticed that this young kid was really into what was happening behind the doors rather than being on the floor. And he gave me the opportunity to come behind in the kitchen and first job as a dishwasher, really, really difficult. But I stuck around and, you know, grew up from dishwasher to prep cook to garde-manger and then grill and then the rest is history. You know, that was back in 1989. And, you know, and I went from one restaurant to another, and I on my way up to become what I became today.
And you actually had two restaurants of your own.
Mm-hmm.
In Brooklyn, was it?
In Brooklyn, yes. One in Bed-Stuy and one in Clinton Hill. The first one, Yolele, it was on Fulton Street in Bed-Stuy, and back was early 2000.
And that's your first cookbook you wrote.
That's right. My first cookbook, Yolele. Yolele is a Fulani word. Fulani is a language, one of the most spoken language in Africa, because it's a language that belongs to a nomadic group that traveled around the continent with their herds, their herders. So they travel looking for pasture, for greener pasture. And I wanted that name, Yolele, because I had this vision of bringing this food that would travel and meet other and bring that culture to other parts of the world, like here in America. It translates for "let the good times roll."
There we go. They stole that from New Orleans, I guess, right?
Well, again, New Orleans and Senegal, we have a lot in common. So
okay.
who took from who, you know, does it matter? You know, we get the best from each.
There's so much in this book that we obviously are not going to be able to touch on all of it. I wanted to mention some of the things that readers and what list our listeners will find in this book. Like you have this Tasting Senegal, which gives a whole lineup of flavor profiles that people can expect.
Mm-hmm.
You have a section that about how everyone eats on a daily basis. You have sections on special holiday foods or events, you know, and so forth. Do you list all these pantry items that you'd find in a Senegalese kitchen? I wanted you to explain a little bit more, because you give as much attention to culture surrounding the food as you do the food. What is the concept teranga?
The concept teranga, you know, would be, if there's a word that really symbolizes Senegal, that would be the word.
That's why I picked it, Pierre.
You did a good, nice pick, and really nice pick. And it's a wall of wood. It's a wall of wood that translates loosely to hospitality, but it's so much more than that. I mean, teranga is a value that every Senegalese is expected to have. You know, that's when you treat your guest as a king, you give him the best treatment. You know, when the guest arrives in your house, either expected or unexpected, whether you know him or you don't know him, you always treat him with teranga. You offer him teranga. You give him the best of your food. You give him the best seat. you give him the best drink, you give him just the best of what you have. So and it's so ingrained in our psyche, we really have that in us. We believe that teranga is the, when you give teranga to the guest, in reality he's bringing blessing to you. So when he cannot refuse the teranga, you know, when, for instance, when you come and you come, oh Peter, you come to a house in Senegal any day at lunchtime or dinner time, you'll be invited. You'll be invited to come and sit around the wall to eat. And even if you have eaten or you're not hungry, you're going to just come and have a handful or spoonful of the meal, because you have to bring the blessing to those people. They expect you to bring the blessing by sharing their meal. So it's a, you know, it's a win-win thing. You treat the guest, and the guest also is bringing you blessing. And that's the deep belief in Senegal. We really, that we treat the guest like that, just because of that deep-seated belief that the guest is really bringing secret blessings to the household. When you share your food in Senegal, the bowl is always going to be plentiful. That's the belief that we have. So you'll never be in, you'll never lack by sharing. You know, again, and there's another way, there's another expression we say over in Senegal, wealth is not measured by how much you have, it's measured by how much you give, by how much you share.
Yeah, there's something else that's very important to me. This book itself, and the other books, I guess, that you've done, you're a spokesperson, a real cheerleader for Senegal. But in addition to that, tell us about Afro Eats.
Afro Eats was again part of the same mission, you know, to introduce that culture. So I envisioned this event where I would bring chefs and other food persons from other parts of the world, and friends and colleagues, and take them to Senegal and have them experience firsthand what I've known, you know, and what I was sure would just turn them, convert them into Senegalese food ambassadors like me. And we did an event, the first Afro-Eats we did, we're planning a second one, but the first Afro-Eats we did, and I traveled to Dakar with New York chefs, you know, Anita Lowe, Dave Arnold. Hello?
Yeah, Anita Lowe, and who else?
Yeah, Anita Lowe, Dave Arnold, Alexander Smalls from Cecil, Jessica Harris, she was a food writer, she's a prolific food writer who wrote quite a few books. Dave Arnold, who had the Moffat Museum of Food, and I'm sure you heard about the Moffat, that's like this big project that's coming up. We had Christian Abegan from France. We had another chef from Côte d'Ivoire, Samuel Becquet. We had another chef from Togo. I'm trying to remember the names now as we go. So it was a nice bunch of us, you know, and we went to Senegal and we met with local chefs, and we met with also food producers. We went on a culinary tour. We traveled with fishermen early morning. We went fishing, because fishing is, you know, as you know, the big part of our diet. So we followed that from catching the fish, and then we went to see where the fish is being dried and salted, and or the conch is being fermented. You know, we followed that, and then we visited monks, because there's a monastery in Senegal where those monks are doing some amazing products with the local food. You know, they're making their own wines using the fruits from baobab and fruits from the hibiscus, you know, flour from the hibiscus. They're making their own liquor. They're making their own cheese with the goat milk from the Fulani farmers and Fulani herders, I mean. And we went to the Pink Lake, which is this amazing lake that has this beautiful pink coloration at certain time of the year. And the amazing thing about this lake is the salt, you know, it has a high salt content. You know, it's so high, it's like the Dead Sea. You float on that lake.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the salt is being harvested traditionally there, and it's a great salt. So we went with the chefs and we collected the salt there. We saw that process. So, you know, we visited markets, of course, beautiful markets, fish markets, vegetable markets, colorful markets. Markets in Africa are so colorful. You know, women always dress up to go to the markets, and they have these colorful head scarves and these great flowing dresses, as you can see in the book.
Yeah, we have a good friend who was born and raised in Gambia.
Okay.
And he's so talented. He makes our son went to school with his daughter, and he makes all the clothes for everyone in his family. He's also an artist and a photographer and a dancer. And
watch out here. Somebody's going to be angling for an invitation to the next Afro Reach.
Oh, you've read my mind.
yes, absolutely, absolutely. The more the merrier. I really would love to have you come over and help us, because the idea is to spread the message, you know. I mean, they came back and they were all converts, and you know, they had, you know, they talk about it. Some of them even had in the recipes in the book. Eric Simeon, another chef, also was with us. He had recipes in the book. You know, they had specials in their restaurant about African food, and all of them are asking about the next Afro-Eats. They're ready to come again, so definitely join us.
I mean, this is a revelation, this book, and it's, listeners, if you really want an introduction to a wonderful culture, not just food culture, but culture in its entirety, look up Senegal. And Pierre Tam, thank you so much for talking to us about it. You make it sound like I can hardly wait to get on the plane for this next trip.
Well, thank you, Anne and Peter. It was a pleasure.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And to finish up the program, we're going to come back to the good old U.S. of A.
Right? Yes. And Monica Van Cleve is going to introduce us to her family's business, a lot of history, and for me, a totally new product called Crab Pie. Well, we're going to be talking to Monica Van Cleve of the famous Van Cleve Seafood Company. Welcome, Monica.
Thank you so much for having me.
First of all, I didn't even know there was such a thing as crab meat pie or crab pie. And so it was a real revelation. And the story that came with it, all the history involved, and it's, the recipe descends from Robert E. Lee. Can you tell us, first of all, how old is your company?
Well, my family has had a seafood business or restaurant market throughout 15 years. We have been exclusively making our famous crab pies and red crab pies, blue crab pies, scallop and bacon pies, and kind of in a larger scale for about 2.5 years. But this recipe has been in my family for over 30 years. My mom was on the banks of the Potomac River 30 years ago, and she was teaching a class on seafood, and she met someone named Laura Payne there, and they got to talking, and they were talking about food, and my mom learned that she was a direct descendant of the cookhouse of Stratford Hall, which is General Robert E. Lee's boyhood home. And her mother and her grandmother had been making a special recipe, and they had told her that this was the Lee family favorite meal that they would eat. And she assured my mom that it was nowhere in the Stratford Hall library of recipes, and it was only in her head, and to make sure she wrote it down and make it for her family. And she did. And not only did she make it for our family with Christmas and Thanksgiving and things like that, holidays, but her mom, my mother's mom, and her opened a colonial restaurant in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and they put it on the menu there many years ago, and it became a customer favorite. And then about 15 years later, my mom opens a seafood restaurant of her own, and my sister and I work there with her, and we put it on the menu, the seafood restaurant. And again, it just took off, and it became a customer favorite, and we noticed customers were making it for their family traditions and holidays and things like that. So this recipe is very special to us. It's very special, obviously, to the Lee family. Has, you know, a slice of Virginia history. It's very unique. And the product itself is very unique. A lot of people, just like you, had never heard of crab pie. And it's wonderful. It's not a quiche, so it's not eggy, and it's something different than a crab cake, which is how we normally enjoy crab in a prepared food here on the East Coast. But it's savory, and the cheese that we put in it doesn't overpower the seafood, which is important. And you know, it's baked in a flaky pastry crust. It's just wonderful.
Well, it certainly is tasty. Now, how many different products do you make?
We make about 5 or 6 different products, and we have 2 or 3 that we're always, you know, trying to add on. And like I said, we've been doing this for 2.5 years, so we're steadily growing our product list. But we started out with the blue crab pie. It's our signature new product, and then we took out the blue crab and we replaced it with red crab meat. Now, red crab, that's another special product because the red crab, called Atlantic red crab, is caught off our coast, our East Coast. And so many people have never heard of it before. But it's caught 7 miles off the coast of New England down to North Carolina, and it's 2,000 feet down. So it's a cold water crab.
Wow.
And it's very similar to a snow crab in taste because it's that cold water crab. But it looks like a Dungeness crab, and it tastes like a snow crab. So we put that in our red crab pie, and it's a bit sweeter and decadent, and it's just wonderful. And we also now have a scallop and bacon pie, and we use sweet, wonderful, sustainable scallops. We put bacon bits, bacon bits in there, and it tastes like a bacon wrap scallop, but in a flaky pastry crust. It's delicious.
And I just had a blue crab pie for lunch, and the preparation couldn't be simpler. Tell us, since you're the expert, what you do. You get your blue crab or your red crab or your scallop pie shipped overnight.
Yep, shipped overnight in dry ice, so it shows up frozen. It's so easy. You just, when they arrive at your door, put them in the freezer. When you're ready to enjoy them, pull them straight out of the freezer. Put the pan, it comes in a special Italian baking pan. You put that right on the oven rack. It bakes 45 minutes. It pops right out of that pan. You discard the pan and you plate. It's really foolproof.
And you eat it, and sadly it only lasts about 4 minutes.
Yes, it's so good, it goes fast.
No, I mean, the flavor is pretty intense, though. I mean, it tastes really crabby.
we pride ourselves in having no fillers. There's nothing but top quality, wonderful blue crab meat, 2 types of cheese, seafood seasonings, and that's it. There's no other filler to mask or to overpower the seafood taste.
You know, I asked you before we started recording, I asked you about, there's been so much scandal about especially, well, crab, blue crab fraud. All seafood seems to be under some sort of cloud of suspicion for fraud, but particularly people were substituting other things when they tested them. I think it was like 80% of the blue crab products actually were not all blue crab. Now, you said this was not affecting your business at all.
Well, we just have to be more careful and do more due diligence with our seafood suppliers. And so that's really the lessons that we've taken from, you know, what's been going on. We have a very close relationship with our suppliers, so this hasn't affected us. But you're right, this is something that does affect the seafood industry. And any seafood product producer knows that they have to be on top of their suppliers.
Now, you mentioned the red crab in our conversation earlier, and you said that that's a deep water crab. Now, what about the blue crab? Does that come from the bay?
It comes from the bay, the Chesapeake Bay. Sometimes we'll pull it in from Louisiana, so Gulf crab. The same species we'll also pull in from Mexico and also Venezuela. So it's the same species crab. It tastes exactly the same. But, you know, we need to be diverse in where we're pulling it from because the bay, the Chesapeake Bay, is so depleted of the crab. So it's good to have different, you know, quality suppliers, you know, around the area.
Is it seasonal too in availability, or can you get it with all these different places? Can you get it all year round?
For domestic crab, absolutely, it's very seasonal. Same if we're getting it from Mexico and Venezuela. Anywhere we're getting it, each region has a season. So, yes, it's always seasonal. With any kind of seafood, it is.
Well, now, you brought up the subject of how to get it. Do you have retail outlets, or is it an Internet-based?
We do. So in the Mid-Atlantic region, we are in Whole Foods. So you can get our scallops and bacon products and soon our blue crab pies in the Whole Foods. And also we are in 61 Giant food stores. We are in King's and Balducci grocery stores, sold on QVC, and, yes, online.
Oh, great. So, because I think I read on your website that Whole Foods, you're restricted at this point, you're restricted to the Mid-Atlantic states?
Well, when you enter any Whole Foods, you don't go, like, straight to corporate and then go to every
Got it,
Whole Foods
got it. No, I understand.
You have to go regional. Yeah.
So you'll go more national in due course, you think?
Absolutely, yep. We have meetings hopefully we'll be in the Southwest region soon, and also the region in Florida very soon as well.
Now, I mean, you are working for the company full-time?
Yes.
Huh. And your sister?
Yes, my sister. She works in the company full-time, and so does my mom. So it's me, my mom, and my sister.
Great. Anyhow, well, it's a very delicious product, and as I said before, it's artisanal, and so, I mean, people should not be surprised that it's not cheap, but it's, you couldn't want a purer kind of taste. It tastes like pure crab.
It's because it is. Yep, it is top quality, and like I said, artisan made, wonderful product. But thank you so much, and I'm so glad that you enjoyed them. I'm glad you enjoyed some for lunch today.
Yes,
there you go. I'll refrain from having any more crab pie until at least next week.
Well, thank you for talking to us, Monica.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
And hello to Shelley, your mom.
I will tell her.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And in case you missed it, these crab pies are really delicious.
Aren't they, though?
So aren't you jealous that we have a family-size one in the freezer?
Right. We're not allowed to have that yet.
We're trying to decide who to share it with. A lucky couple coming along there somewhere. But in the meantime, I guess we have to get ready for next week's program. So we hope we'll see you again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.